Welcome to NEJM This Week. I'm Dr. Lisa Johnson. In this episode, we look at new trials on deferring arterial catheterization in shock, beta blocker use after myocardial infarction, and a treatment for triple negative breast cancer. We review acromegaly. A case describes a man with dyspnea, edema, and pacemaker lead displacement. We explore perspectives on the burdens of primary care, the erosion of harm reduction, child health policy, and the meaning of hospice. Deferring arterial catheterization in critically ill patients with shock, by Grégoire Muller, from the Centre Hospitalier Universitaire d'Orléans, France, and co-authors. The use of an arterial catheter is common in the intensive care unit and is recommended for the treatment of patients with shock, although evidence from randomized trials is lacking. The detection of arterial hypotension and its response to therapy is of utmost importance in patients with shock. In this context, continuous real-time accurate blood pressure measurements obtained by means of an arterial catheter are presumed to enable earlier detection of hypotensive episodes, prompt initiation of volume expansion, and timely vasopressor dose adjustment, thereby minimizing the duration of undertreatment or overtreatment and potentially influencing the course of organ failure and ultimately survival. However, these assumptions rest on expert opinion and have not been tested in randomized trials. In this trial, 1,010 patients who had shock and had been admitted to an intensive care unit within the past 24 hours were randomly assigned to receive early insertion of an arterial catheter within 4 hours after randomization, or to be monitored with an automated brachial cuff. The results for death from any cause at day 28 indicated that management without early arterial catheter insertion was non-inferior to early catheter insertion. Haley Gershengorn from the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine writes in an editorial that this trial should profoundly affect ICU practice by instigating a shift away from a knee-jerk invasive approach to blood pressure monitoring in patients with shock. Some patients will receive invasive treatment, but this approach can be an exception rather than the rule. And guidelines, which address how to care for most patients, can evolve. Questions remain. Should the approach to post-surgical patients be different from the approach to non-surgical patients? Are arterial catheters beneficial in critical illnesses not involving shock, such as hypertension-associated intracranial hemorrhage? Shared decision-making may be needed to understand how individual patients weigh the risks of pain and discomfort against those of catheter-related complications. But a new day has dawned, and it is one in which many more ICU patients should be able to wave good morning without fear of ripping out an arterial catheter. Beta blockers after myocardial infarction without reduced ejection fraction, by Jorge Ibanez, from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, New York, and co-authors. Beta blockers have long been a foundational treatment after acute myocardial infarction. Their use was initially supported by the results of early randomized trials, which showed a 23% lower risk of death among patients who received beta blockers than among those in control groups at 2 years. However, those trials were conducted in an era that predates what is now modern standard care. Routine reperfusion, invasive management, complete revascularization, and potent adjunctive therapies such as dual antiplatelet therapy and statins. Therefore, re-examining the role of beta blockers is warranted. This randomized trial conducted in Spain and Italy evaluated the effect of beta blocker therapy as compared with no beta blocker therapy in 8,438 patients with acute myocardial infarction with or without ST segment elevation and a left ventricular ejection fraction above 40%. During a median follow-up of 3.7 years, a primary outcome event of a composite of death from any cause, reinfarction, or hospitalization for heart failure occurred in 316 patients, 22.5 events per 1,000 patient years in the beta blocker group, and in 307 patients, 21.7 events per 1,000 patient years in the no beta blocker group. In this trial, beta blocker therapy appeared to have no effect on the incidence of death from any cause, reinfarction, or hospitalization for heart failure. Beta blockers after myocardial infarction in patients without heart failure. By John Munkhaugen from the Drammen Hospital, Norway, and co-authors. In this trial conducted in Denmark and Norway, 5,574 patients who had had a myocardial infarction and who had a left ventricular ejection fraction of at least 40% were randomly assigned to receive long-term beta blocker therapy within 14 days after the event or no beta blocker therapy. After a median follow-up of 3.5 years, a primary endpoint of a composite of death from any cause or a major adverse cardiovascular event, new myocardial infarction, unplanned coronary revascularization, ischemic stroke, heart failure, or malignant ventricular arrhythmia, had occurred in 14.2% of patients in the beta blocker group and in 16.3% of those in the no beta blocker group. Among these patients, beta blocker therapy led to a lower risk of death or major adverse cardiovascular events than no beta blocker therapy. Sacituzumab govitecan in untreated advanced triple negative breast cancer. By Javier Cortez from Pangea Oncology, Barcelona, Spain, and co-authors. Patients with previously untreated, locally advanced, unresectable, or metastatic triple-negative breast cancer who are not candidates for inhibitors of programmed cell death protein 1, PD-1, or programmed death ligand 1, PD-L1, have limited treatment options. Sacituzumab govitecan is an antibody-drug conjugate that releases a potent topoisomerase 1 inhibitor through a hydrolyzable linker at a high drug-to-antibody ratio. In this trial, 558 patients with advanced triple-negative breast cancer who were not candidates for treatment with PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitors were randomly assigned to receive sacituzumab govitecan or chemotherapy. Sacituzumab govitecan led to significantly longer progression-free survival than chemotherapy among these patients. The incidence of adverse events of grade 3 or higher with sacituzumab govitecan was similar to that with chemotherapy, but adverse events were common.
I'm Darren Teichman, a deputy editor at the New England Journal of Medicine. I've been a full-time medical journal editor for over 15 years, but I've never stopped seeing patients. Just like the other full-time physician editors on our team, I continue to practice medicine for a couple of reasons. Most importantly, I love it. It's who I am. It's who I trained to be. I've known many of my patients for over 20 years, and I don't want to lose those connections. I also think seeing patients makes me a better editor. When we sit around the table and discuss papers, my colleagues and I can understand why the questions asked by the research studies we're considering are important or not to practicing clinicians because we see patients ourselves. I love this work because I always learn a lot. And the goal is simple: to help our authors clearly, honestly, and concisely communicate their findings to our readers so they, in turn, can use what they read to help their patients. It certainly helps me take better care of my patients. We're published by the Massachusetts Medical Society, a not-for-profit publisher, and we rely on subscriptions from individual readers, medical schools, and libraries to fund what we do.
Acromegaly, A review article by Andrea Giustina from the San Raffaele Vita Salute University, Milan, and Anna Maria Colleo from the Federico II University, Napoli, both in Italy. Acromegaly is a chronic disfiguring disease that leads to a poor quality of life and decreased survival as a result of multiple coexisting systemic factors. It results from excess growth hormone secretion by generally benign adenomas arising in adult pituitary somatotrophs. Diagnostic delay, even a delay of 10 years or more, is common and is a major determinant of disease severity. The role of clinicians in reducing diagnostic delay is crucial, since specific findings occur in multiple organs and should trigger a suspicion of acromegaly early in the disease course. Once suspected, the clinician evaluating the patient should order an insulin-like growth factor 1 assay. Pituitary surgery is the primary treatment option for most people with acromegaly, though multimodal treatment is often needed to control acromegaly. Improved surgical techniques, wider availability of molecular profiling of tumors, new targeted drugs, and improved clinical monitoring may ameliorate the outcome. A 79-year-old man with dyspnea, edema, and pacemaker lead displacement. A case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by Jinlei Liu from the Third Affiliated Hospital of Sun Yat-sen University, Guangzhou, China, and co-authors. A 79-year-old man was admitted to the Third Affiliated Hospital of Sun Yat-sen University because of dyspnea and edema in the arms and legs. The patient had previously undergone coronary stenting for myocardial infarction. 2 months earlier, the patient had undergone placement of a permanent pacemaker because of sinus arrest. The current examination revealed elevated jugular venous pressure and symmetric edema. Transthoracic echocardiography showed a new 5-centimeter mass obliterating the right atrium and encompassing the pacemaker lead. CT angiography demonstrated a 10-centimeter atrial mass encasing the right coronary artery with mediastinal lymphadenopathy and pulmonary nodules. FDG PET-CT revealed marked uptake in the atrial mass and a right hilar lymph node. Biopsy of this node showed diffuse proliferation of large B cells. The histopathological findings established a diagnosis of primary cardiac diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. The cardiac tumor was thought to have caused pacemaker lead displacement and possibly earlier sinus node dysfunction due to subendocardial infiltration. PCPs, APPs, and the everything bagel problem. Choosing not to choose. A Medicine and Society article by Lisa Rosenbaum, a national correspondent for the journal. Primary care has become an everything bagel, overloaded with worthy goals that threaten its core purpose. Compounding tasks such as mandatory screenings, safety checks, preventive care measures, population health mandates, and administrative tasks have turned primary care physicians, PCPs, into de facto administrative assistants. The weight of these tasks may threaten the skills critical to managing complex chronic disease. As advanced practice practitioners, APPs, who are generally nurse practitioners or physician assistants, increasingly deliver primary care, the field faces a deeper misunderstanding of what primary care should entail. Studies comparing APPs and physicians show mixed results, but comprehensiveness is probably the aspect of primary care most threatened by removing physicians from the equation. Replacing PCPs with APPs may make business sense, but the greatest tragedy of the scope of practice battles is not the expansion of nurse practitioner or physician assistant practice, it's the narrowing of the primary care physician's practice. Ultimately, the inability or the unwillingness to choose among competing priorities, to pile too much on the bagel, is itself a choice. Within primary care, this failure to choose has resulted in an impossible task load estimated to require nearly 27 hours per day to complete. The erosion of harm reduction, a perspective by Joshua Barocas from the University of Colorado School of Medicine, Aurora. Harm reduction, as defined by the Drug Policy Alliance, is a set of ideas and interventions that seek to reduce the harms associated with both drug use and punitive drug policies. Harm reduction is embodied in syringe services programs, naloxone distribution, overdose education, overdose prevention centers, and decriminalization of drugs. Harm reduction is being eroded by means of the dismantling of funding mechanisms, the imposition of punitive laws, and the use of rhetoric that undermines its legitimacy. In recent months, the U.S. administration has continuously chipped away at public health interventions addressing substance use disorders and the opioid crisis. Cuts began with the closure of HIV prevention branches and the dismantling of the Office of Infectious Disease and HIV/AIDS Policy. Funding has been delayed or withheld for the Overdose Data to Action program, and massive funding cuts and layoffs at the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA, have halted the National Survey on Drug Use and Health. An executive order issued July 24th prohibits federal SAMHSA discretionary grants from being used to fund harm reduction activities, proposes a freeze on federal funding to organizations that provide, quote, drug paraphernalia, and threatens legal action against harm reduction organizations. The order bans federal funds for pipes or other supplies for safer smoking kits and syringes or needles, and restricts the use of funds for sterile water, saline, or ascorbic acid when used in the context of harm reduction. These measures undermine access to vital services and worsen the opioid crisis. Religious liberty as a shield for public health. The case of overdose prevention centers. A perspective by Benjamin Barsky from the University of California College of the Law, San Francisco, and co-authors. A federal appeals court ruling in United States versus Safe House could mark a shift in the way courts treat efforts to prevent drug overdoses and to support public health more broadly. The court held that Safe House, a Philadelphia-based nonprofit seeking to open an overdose prevention center, may assert religious liberty claims to override federal controlled substances law, despite being a non-religious organization. The, quote, crack house provision of the Controlled Substances Act imposes civil and criminal penalties on people who knowingly and intentionally make facilities available for the purpose of unlawful drug use. Safe House argues that its board members' sincere religious belief in protecting human health and life is burdened by government enforcement. The court ruling made it clear that Safe House is eligible for protection under Hobby Lobby, extending religious liberty claims to non-religious entities. The decision offers hope for public health advocates in a period marked by retrenchment of harm reduction strategies, as several states impose stricter drug penalties and the Trump administration has signaled that it intends to undo many of the Biden administration's harm reduction policies. In this political climate, strategies based on the free exercise of religion may be more successful. Truly prioritizing child health, the missed opportunities of the MAHA Commission. A perspective by James Perrin from Mass General Brigham for Children, Boston, and Tina Cheng from the Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center. The Make America Healthy Again, MAHA Commission, has focused welcome and long overdue attention on the health and well-being of U.S. children. However, its strategy misses real opportunities to address the chronic disease epidemic and whole person health. The recent commission report highlights poor diet, environmental chemicals, lack of physical activity, and chronic stress, and over-medicalization, yet ignores leading contributors to rising childhood morbidity and mortality, firearm injuries, drug overdoses, and motor vehicle injuries. Most striking is the report's silence regarding the association of poverty with poor child health. Policies such as child tax credits, paid family leave, and early nutrition assistance have been shown to improve outcomes. Yet such policies do not align with the current administration's priorities. The Commission's recommendations include a long-held concern about children's diets, but suggests only marginal changes such as reducing the use of food dyes and reducing consumption of ultra-processed foods. An appropriate focus on environmental chemicals, but the strategy involves only few research projects and no regulatory change, and concerns about medications, especially stimulants and psychotropic agents. But the report suggests only studying prescribing patterns and does not address more fundamental ways of changing medication use. Specifically, current incentives drive diagnosis and treatment rather than prevention and health promotion. What is hospice? A perspective by Teva Brender from the University of California, San Francisco. What is hospice? The patient asks, looking in the direction of the TV he is not watching. His eldest son sits in a chair on the bed's port side. His face previously inscrutable, a portrait of stern fortitude this past week, now cracking beneath the strain of reality, uncertainty, and subacute sleep deprivation. The teenage daughter sets down a book. Only she makes piercing, unbroken eye contact. Hospice is a service, but it's really a philosophy, Dr. Brender begins. When someone is near the end of life, when they have less than 6 months to live, they can choose to focus on comfort rather than curing or treating their disease. The goal of hospice is to manage symptoms and improve the quality of the life you have left. Hospice programs include doctors, nurses, social workers, and counselors. They guide you and your family through the dying process, physically, emotionally, spiritually. This is what Dr. Brender says, reciting the spiel a senior resident once gave to him and that had been imparted to the senior resident a few years earlier, passed down to each successive cohort of interns by the residents who preceded them. The family is lost, adrift, casting about for terra firma in a temperamental sea. Their captain, the oncologist, has finally said that chemotherapy is no longer an option. And yet, hospice sounds like loss, surrender, defeat, the end. Dr. Brender continues, I want to assure you that if you choose hospice, it doesn't mean you're giving up. But hospice is infinitely complicated. Perhaps it's simpler and more honest to say, hospice is always sad. If all goes well, painless, and sometimes heartbreakingly beautiful. In our images in clinical medicine, a previously healthy 8-year-old boy presented with a 7-day history of an itchy rash on both cheeks and a lacy rash on his chest and arms, a diagnosis of erythema infectiosum, also known as Fifth disease, was made. Erythema infectiosum is a viral exanthem caused by parvovirus B19. It may involve a viral prodrome before the onset of the rash. In another image, an 89-year-old woman with severe tricuspid regurgitation presented with fever and cough after a recent diagnosis of influenza. Prominent forehead venous pulsations were noted on examination and shown in a video at nejm.org. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.